I'm pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
It's great to talk to you as always, Michael.
Martin, spring is in the air, new shoots of life. It seems to bring optimism with it. Martin, last time we met, I was deep in a pessimistic state of being, but those green shoots that I'm seeing, those signs of spring around Frio, perhaps mean maybe I can sort of adopt a more cautiously optimistic approach to the world, Martin, but can I? What about Ukraine? Have we got anywhere since the president's met?
I don't know that we've got very far at all. We'll sort of walk through that. Look, to be fair to him, Donald Trump is trying. He appears to be investing some time and energy into this. But I think that, and we've discussed this before, is probably overestimated the level of interest that Putin might have in being involved in this. Well, let's unpack this a little bit. There was some excitement and anticipation when Donald Trump announced that he and Putin would be having their first high-level summit of this term of the presidency. And I think it was the first time that Putin had met one-on-one for at least back to Trump's first term with a US president. So that was all looking promising. And you sort of think, well, the point of these summits is that you usually have something that's an outcome. You don't usually commit to something unless there's an outcome. Anyway, they met up in Alaska, and I don't think they came away with much at all. There were some suggestions. So the part that has looked promising at times, but we're not sure how far it will go, is this business about security guarantees for Ukraine. And it's not that they'll be allowed to be part of NATO or they'll be given the same guarantee there, but Trump and European leaders were working towards something of that ilk. Whether it would be guaranteed by America or guaranteed by Europe, that they would, whether they station troops or just offer some formal commitment to protecting Ukraine should against further Russian aggression in the future. Because the problem that Ukraine faces, if they agree to a deal, what's to stop Russia regrouping and having another crack in the next decade? I mean, this is the second crack they had. They had the first go in 2014 and took Crimea and parts of the eastern Donbass, and then they went again in 2022. So, as part of any peace deal, Ukraine's seeking and Europe's seeking some guarantee against aggression.
What was interesting, so far as the theatrics of the meeting were concerned, Martin, to me, is that we had this great meeting in Alaska. No one much talked about it, but Yalta, towards the end of the Second World War on the Black Sea, you had Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt meeting to start carving up the world, I suppose, at that point, at least getting over the Second World War. And it's sort of in its own strange way suggested my green shoots of optimism. But then the president went home. We were then told that President Zelensky was going to be flying in on the Monday to DC to talk to the president about what else might have happened. And of course, he'd been cut out of those earlier talks. And then lo and behold, before we knew it, a bundle of the European leaders turned up to back up Zelensky. And it struck me that might be a clear indication about the future, that America would contract and the EU, the European, the NATO countries, apart from the US, would have to step up into all of this. Am I onto anything?
Oh, you are onto something. So Trump's response to all this is the US has spent too much money, time, and resources in this. We want a peace deal, but if there's going to be security guarantees or heavy lifting, it's got to be Europe that does it. And that was his kind of message to European leaders when they rock up. Of course, the other part of this too, Michael, is what does Russia want? Russia wants a carve-up of territory, don't they? They want a slice of Ukraine so they can justify all this time and energy and resources. And that is, I think their demands include areas that are currently controlled by Ukraine.
Well,
That the,
they want the Donbass region, which is rich in natural
yeah.
resources.
Yeah. So, I mean, I came away from all of this still pretty pessimistic that they're a long way apart in terms of what their actual demands are and what they'll accept. Maybe there'll be some kind of breakthrough, but at this point in time, I'm not convinced.
Well, it seems pretty clear, as you suggest, that the US doesn't want to, in that sense, become embroiled in a European war. They don't want to have all their missiles and service people planted on Ukraine soil facing Russia. They might be prepared to pay for and send in armaments to be used by Ukraine and its partners. But what is going to happen? I mean, people having a fight out in the backyard would just face up and bloody the noses and see what comes of it all. Are we going to have that sort of result?
Well, the next step's not clear. So Trump said that Zelensky and Trump and Putin might meet, or even without me, he said. Well, I can't see that working very well because the two men don't like each other, and they both don't want to give ground. So I can't see the two of them just getting together to sort out their issues. They'd need some kind of arbiter, wouldn't they, to bash heads. And this is the slight craziness factor as well. So after pushing for peace, periodically Trump threatens either Russia or Ukraine at one time or another, and says, well, Ukraine, well, you could be on your own then with just Europe. And then Russia, he sort of threatens periodically with sanctions. And then remember when he set that deadline for Russia, either make peace by this time or the sanctions coming. Well, that's long past. So the kind of the lack of consistency probably is a bit of a problem in forcing the actors onto the stage.
Remind us and our listeners again of the nickname for President Trump.
It's Taco. Trump always chickens out.
There's a diplomatic term that's often used here too, and it says that he does sweet FA, and that seems to apply here, Martin. So I'm as pessimistic, I suppose, you're telling me, or I should be, as I was last week. The Russians are still raining bombs from drones and attacking Ukrainian strongholds or everything else without respite. We don't know where it's going. We sit powerlessly and watch. Trump's done his best. You said he was trying. My mother used to say that I was trying when I was a young boy too. It's a little bit like that. Well, let's leave my depression, if not yours, to one side and turn to Gaza. More on Gaza. What's your latest mail on Gaza? Will they or won't they have a ceasefire or a peace settlement?
So apparently Hamas has said that they're willing to cut a deal that sees them release half the remaining hostages, those that might be dead or alive, in exchange for a ceasefire for a duration of time. Look, any step forward is a step forward, I guess, in that conflict. It's not clear at this stage whether Netanyahu will entertain that at all. He's made a few different noises. Of course, Netanyahu's recently announced that he's charging into Gaza City now and is going to retake that. That would be a very bloody venture. That will be a very bloody venture. There'll be many more lives lost in that exercise. Michael, the one extra development this week, and it's a further unseemly development, is this war of words between Netanyahu and Albanese. And it's quite extraordinary. You don't often see this between two world leaders. And basically, Netanyahu's gone on the attack and accused Albanese of being weak. Albanese's chosen to occupy the high ground for now, and had his ministers respond, and then of which the strongest language was used by Tony Burke, who said, "You don't become strong by the number of people you blow up or the number of children that are starving." So that was pretty, strong language from Tony Burke there. So that diplomatic relationship has been deteriorating further. And then we had Sky News interviewing Netanyahu this week, etc. I think Netanyahu's comments are really for the Israeli audience, and he wants to be the wartime leader. That's what he's trying to do. He's facing increasing domestic opposition at home, and I think this is in response to that.
Well, Jewish people in Australia are not all on the same page when it comes to Mr. Netanyahu and his comments. There was some important dissent from what he said about our Prime Minister.
Even some groups which have been previously critical of Labor have weighed in to say that these comments by Netanyahu are unhelpful. So I think that it does make Jewish groups quite uncomfortable because, as we've discussed before, I mean, anti-Semitism is real, does happen, and when you have these wars of words, they're probably worried that it might become worse in that sense. So I think that's and that the Jewish population in Australia might become the meat in the sandwich between Australia's decision to recognise a Palestinian state and then this sort of furious reaction from Netanyahu.
I suppose the optimist in me would like to think that Netanyahu is pushing hard at the moment with his war cabinet, saying he's prepared, and in fact, they're already on some views pushing into Gaza, and in order to finally force a peace settlement where Hamas says, "All right, you can have all of the hostages back, dead or alive, not just 10 of the 20 who Israel think are alive," but to force a final outcome. Do you think there's something in that, or do you think that Netanyahu's just completely bloody minded about this? He's going in come hell or high water.
Look, if that may be part of the strategy, I still think that there's clearly people in his cabinet, whether he holds this view, but certainly some in his cabinet do, that believe you can just use the military to just crush your opposition, and deal with the consequences there. That yes, the military capacity of Hamas has been severely degraded, but the collateral loss, and that's a dispassionate term, the loss of human life, the devastating loss of human life, and the magnitude of that has been extraordinary. So, there's how far do they go? I think that there's probably there's also some people probably in his cabinet that would be feeling the pressure, and there is domestic pressure now in Israel to try and end the war.
Well, there's a press report just out showing that even on the Israeli government figures, a significantly large number of civilians, nothing to do with the fighting, who have been killed in this war to date. Martin, let's leave that, come to something that looks a little bit gentler. Doesn't seem to have had too many passions expressed in it, and that's the Productivity Roundtable, much trumpeted. We've touched on it last week and before. There seems to be a few outcomes from it. 3 days of 3 days of yarning. Are you feeling better as a result of it?
Look, I think there's going to be some outcomes to this. I don't know if they're earth-shattering or that, landmark stuff, but there will be some outcomes to this that might help. So the broader, there's they've had different tranches and themes along the way. Tax reform, housing, other, industrial relations, all considered, and they're meaty topics. Whilst we won't get a big change to, say, our taxation system or a range of other things like that out of this, I think there might be some tinkering around the edges. So there are major problems in supply chain for housing, for instance, due to regulations in the construction sector through to lack of people, basically, in the right places to build houses. That kind of work is not very sexy, but it's actually really important in trying to improve the supply chain. And likewise, in a number of other projects, there shouldn't be just a watering down of environmental protection, but there might be ways to make this clearer and more transparent for all concerned. So it's not too many layers of the same thing. So I think it's more around the edges that where we may see some outcomes that emanate from this.
I'm one of those who fervently believes, Martin, that when someone comes up with an idea which is meant to be temporary, it'll go on for a damn good time. I can remember my father as the principal of a brand new primary school, which brought him back from the country to Perth when he was still a relatively young man in his 30s, and opened the Kilbellup Primary School in near Fremantle. No longer there, it's now housing, I think, or a park. But he was given some demountable temporary classrooms, Martin. They're just there for a short time, but they last forever, these things. And For example, in here we've got the National Construction Code, and they're proposing pausing changes to the code until mid 2029. So that's, some 4 years away. One cynically thinks once they make these changes, relax standards, change the environmental requirements, that they'll probably remain forever. It's policy change by stealth. Or am I being too cynical?
I think I hope there's enough diverse voices in the room so that what we get, this is my optimism. I don't know if I'll transpire, Michael. Changes that might make things clearer, but changes that don't just water down requirements, because I think they're not exactly the same thing. So if you are a builder, say, and you go into a project and you know exactly what's required of you, and if you meet all of those benchmarks or requirements, for want of a better word, that this project will receive approval, and that approval will come in a timely matter. That would be a way of ensuring that all of these standards are met, but at the same time giving people that are investing in that area a sense of surety, and they can do the investment, but also completion on time, which is important. I think that's the nirvana you're trying to get to. I don't know whether we can, but that's what we should be aiming at.
I mean, they say there's a backlog of 30,000 housing approvals under the EPBC Act, the Environmental Act. I mean, well, there might be, but I mean, we've always had approval systems in this country. Maybe they're capable of being improved. Maybe pausing the National Construction Code means that you can build without having to change the standards midstream as you take a few years to build an apartment block without changing the rules that that govern fireproofing and the like. But then, as you've said, you need people to, you need workers to build these things, and we seem to be short on it. And there's been a discussion about how you incentivize employers to train workers. Unions, of course, want levies, paid business wants incentives for apprenticeships. I don't know, but that must be soluble, and it must be possible just to say, if you're the government, this is what we're going to do. Let's start doing it and see if that helps.
I think incentives are actually easier. They're expensive, but they're actually easier, and that's because all the government needs to do is to incentivize, give businesses money to bring on apprentices and support them. And then for a business, every apprenticeship's pretty good value because they're not costing that business much. So in theory, at least, that should be the easier part. I think that trying to, we always say that these regulations need to change or need to be simplified, but we live in a federation, and our federation has national, state, and local laws and bylaws, and they're messy and they don't always intersect very well.
Martin, the prospect of AI seems to infect absolutely everything these days. I went to a very interesting Sir Walter Murdoch oration at Murdoch University, not far from Fremantle, last night, where High Court Justice James Edelman spoke. And amongst other things, he touched upon in trying to imagine how the law will develop and respond to things over the next 50 years. He's still a young man. AI, of course, comes up. But it doesn't matter what you talk about, whether it's your education system, whether it's building buildings, whether it's farmers, you name it. AI is everywhere. And I think it's been touched upon, but probably without any real resolution at the round table.
Yeah, got to mention a few times. I think there's different attitudes in this area. Part of it is that AI is an innovation and it's a tool, and you have to embrace technology. And then there's another perspective that says, yes, that's all great, but what about the human dimension, and what about preserving, the licensing and creativity of people that have created things that will just be cannibalized by AI? So there's a number of different perspectives that need to be fed into this here. We've got a danger with AI that we do what we did with the internet. I think we're really slow as governments and other bodies in understanding the impact of the internet on what we did. And everything from digital safety and cybersecurity and the like took years to catch up and was always seen to be behind where the technology was. So the challenge here for governments to try and predict the future, and then try and work out how they can be proactive in, managing the right, policy settings.
Martin, we're coming to the end of this podcast, but I don't think I saw anything about negative gearing at the round table. I've always thought it's a pity there's not a country smaller than New Zealand, perhaps, that otherwise looks very much like Australia does in relation to its tax settings, who's prepared to have a go at getting rid of negative gearing to see what happens. It'd be very interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, the economists no doubt can use AI to predict what might happen.
Well, maybe that's where AI can be useful. We said at the outset that they weren't really canvassing bigger picture or more substantive things. They were tinkering at the edges. And before the roundtable started, Jim Chalmers ruled out changes to negative gearing. So that was kind of dead in the water. And the other big change that people have proposed is amending the capital gains tax. Which itself is said to cost the budget a huge amount of money and allows, like negative gearing does, older people to be in more financially advantageous positions and younger people to find housing really, really difficult. And that was part of that housing conversation. There's a really interesting analysis, macro analysis around our economy that says older people are now accumulating wealth and younger people are really struggling. And our tax and policy settings not only facilitate it, they contribute to it.
Well, do you think that Jim Chalmers might want to become a latter-day Paul Keating and do some really bold things in the tax world?
I think you get the sense in the way that he talks that he would want to. You get that sense. I think Albanese is the handbrake, and I think it's because Albanese sees that the middle road, the more cautious route, has been enormously successful for him to date. And I don't think he really wants to change.
Well, I'm getting the feeling that you're neither surprised nor particularly unpleased at the way the roundtable has gone and whatever the outcomes are from it. And there might be some modest changes. If there are to be, they'd need to legislate them pretty quickly, wouldn't they?
Oh, on the contrary, I think there might be some time before we see some actual change emanating here. There might be a few things the government tries to do straight away, but I think I'm not holding my breath.
Don't you think there's a national appetite for doing some bold things, Martin, in the light of the housing crisis in particular?
In that sense, yes. I think that there is certainly on the housing crisis, there's an appetite, and then there's the government looks at who the winners and losers are, and I think that's what worries them.
Oh, the election's not that far away now, Martin. They'll be planning for it.
Well, I mean, they've got the majority, haven't they? They've actually got, and the opposition are still trying to work themselves out, sort of licking their wounds after the election. So now would be the time to probably get on the front foot if they were planning something.
And the only other question, Martin, before we go is why hasn't the Commonwealth moved to 4-year terms of government rather than having elections every 3?
The Constitution doesn't permit it. So the Constitution it effectively embeds 3-year terms, and that would be a big step, I imagine. There's some discussion about whether a fixed 3-year term is possible. Constitutional law experts have different some different views on that, but they couldn't move to a 4-year term without a referendum.
Oh, damn, Martin. We have to keep talking about politics regularly in that case. Even the Roundhouse will be back next Friday for sure, then.
Look forward to it.
Thanks, Martin. Lovely talking to you again.